Billy Rose was a low rider. Billy Rose was a night fighter. Billy Rose knew trouble like the sound of his own name. Busted on a drunken charge, driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. I believe he fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded.
For International Women's Day, the Prison Pipeline team, Brenda Escobar, engineer, and host Ruth Kovach, are thinking about women in prison. Today, we begin by presenting a dramatization called Her Song, written by Kathleen O'Shea. And it presents women on death row in America today, their hopes and survival. This play was presented in John F. Kennedy Center Theater for Performing Arts in 2009 by the Safe Streets Arts Foundation and begins with a song, Good Morning Heartache.
Good morning, heartache, you old gloomy sight. Good morning, heartache. Thought we said goodbye last night. I tossed and turned until it seemed you had gone. But here you are with the dawn. Wish I'd forget you, but you're here to stay. It seemed I met you when my love went away. Now every day I find myself saying to you, good morning, heartache, what's new? Stop haunting me now. Can't shake you, no how. Straight through Sunday blues. Good morning, heartache, here we go again. Good morning, heartache, you're the one who knew me well. Might as well get used to you just hanging around. Good morning, heartache, sit down.
When I ask Kelly what her life is like from day to day, she says,
it's like hanging from a cliff with someone stepping on your fingers.
Not long ago, she was a go-go dancer, the mother of five, and free. The day I talk to her, she is on death row in Pennsylvania. In restraints, ankles shackled to her waist, handcuffs behind her back, she comes in stooped and shuffling. I see her through the double-pane, bulletproof window. Although we've corresponded for 2 years, this is the first time we've met. We will face each other in a separate plexiglass booth, the world looking in. Her face is red and taut, and there's anger in her eyes. She hasn't seen me yet. I watch as they lock her in. She backs up to the door and squats. I see a small slot in the door, about knee level. She sticks her cuffed hands through. The two guards are in no hurry to remove her cuffs and pretend not to see her hands. So she stays in that position a while longer. It's a little surreal, almost like watching a movie. A reminder of who's in charge. Finally, they unlock the cuffs. She is free and not free.
I am Louise.
I am Janine.
I am Louise.
I am Janine.
I am Shonda.
I am Shonda.
I am Linda.
I am Linda.
I am Valerie.
I am Valerie.
I am your mother, your grandmother, your daughter, your wife, your sister, your aunt, your cousin, your friend. I am one of 52 women on death row in 15 states today. I am one of the mothers of approximately 200 children we have given birth to. I am one of 32 battered women. I am Deborah. I am Wendy.
I am Deborah.
I am Wendy.
I am Dora.
I am Angela.
I am Dora.
I am Kathy.
I am Dora. I am Kathy.
I am Caucasian. I am Latino. I am Native American. I am Black. I have been found guilty of murdering my abusers, my children, my husband, my grandchildren, the police, my friends, and of being an accomplice to such murders. I am Celeste.
I am Celeste.
I am
Socorro.
I am Tierra.
I am Carlette.
I am Lisa.
I am Lisa.
I have been both loved and cursed. Of me, it has been said, they get what they deserve. May their names be erased from the book of life.
Kelly speaks quickly without preliminaries, as if we've known each other for years. She's agitated. There are tears in her eyes. She's short of breath. Her wrists are red, with deep ruts as if the cuffs were exceptionally tight. The window between us has two small holes we are supposed to speak through. We sit on high stools facing each other. The guards wander off and we are alone. I tell her to take deep breaths and calm herself. I will wait. Though I wonder how I can say the part about being calm to someone condemned to death. With her left hand, she brushes a strand of her long sandy hair out of her eyes, and I notice both her arms are horribly scarred and some of her fingers only stubs. I ask her if her hands hurt. I'm talking about the marks from the cuffs, but she thinks I'm referring to her scars and says,
"Oh, the fire. It was 25 years ago in November. I was just a baby, and my mother and I were the only two that couldn't get out."
She then explains how she watched her mother die in the flames, though only 5 years old. She says she tried to beat the fire off her mother and some of her fingers melted together. She explains how she felt embarrassed and humiliated about her looks as a child. Speaking of her mother reminds her of her own children. She says that at the time of her incarceration, their ages were 9, 7, 5, 3, and 8 months. Three are now with relatives. One is with a friend, and the youngest child was put up for adoption. She has occasional visits with the children who are with relatives, but since they are non-contact visits, she says the children are pulling away. She talks about her grandparents, devout Catholics who raised her, and her grandmother in particular, who seldom visits because of her age and also because these visits are just too difficult. She explains how the things she liked to do the most on the outside were cooking, cleaning, and taking care of her kids. She particularly loved to clean. Now she says,
"Three times a week we're given a bucket of disinfectant to clean ourselves, but I've had the same cleaning rag for months. I wash myself full of shampoo. When I lay down on my bunk, I put the covers over my head, not to see the dirt. I can't reach. It's like lying in your own casket, which I guess is good preparation for what's to come."
I just listen.
I am Carrie. I am Susan.
I am Carrie.
I am Susan.
I am Veronica.
I am
Maureen.
I am
Erica.
I am Maureen. I am Erica.
In Idaho, I'm Robin. I've been here for 14 years, alone. I am in lockdown 23 hours a day in a part of the prison where there are no other women. I do not see anyone except the three shifts the guards were assigned to watch over me every day. And although I'm alone, I am strip searched, chained, and shackled, and accompanied by two guards whenever I leave my cell even to take a shower. And although no one else is anywhere near the area, the guard announces death row walk-in when I leave my cell. I don't imagine taking a shower handcuffed. Even though I am never out of sight, I am strip searched again when I return myself. Every so often, even though I have seen no one, the guard comes in and takes my cell apart, day or night. If they're feeling bored, they can strip search me again and again. Except for my captors, I have not been touched by another human being for 12 years. I am allowed one roll of toilet paper every 2 weeks.
One week I cried so much I used up all I had in 3 days. So I went without toilet paper for 8 days. I'm supposed to talk to the prison psychologist once a month. If I refuse, I have privileges taken away. Last summer, after I was given my first death warrant, that's when they tell you when your execution day is. The prison psychologist came by and told me he heard I'd been a little depressed. X laughed. But I knew better. I've learned that for my own sake, I have to try to get behind their thoughts. So I have to ask myself what would happen to me if I say I'm not depressed, and what will happen if I say I am. Either way, it could be bad in here. So I opt for the middle road. I said I'd been a little depressed, but I thought I was handling it well. That evening, a squad showed up in riot gear. The strip searched myself and me, left me naked on suicide watch for 3 days.
In my solitude,
here's some data about women on death row. As of October 31st, 2010, there were 51 women on death row. None of them were in Oregon, 16 in California, 10 were in Texas, and between 1 and 4 elsewhere in the United States. 15 states have ended the death penalty. Oregon still has it. The states that have ended it are Alaska, Hawaii, Iowa, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Vermont, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. Since 1976, there have been 1,242 executions in the U.S. Of those, 46 were women. The highest number of executions was 98 back in 1999. There have been 138 exonerations nationwide since 1976.
Portrait of a Prisoner by Maria Ann Moon. This poetry contest was an open door, a transparent window for the world to see. An art gallery for people like me. Broken vases, abstract faces, shattered to pieces on the jail cell floor. Dark side of society behind these walls, I refuse to paint a pretty picture of myself without stretch marks to make myself look good. We paint more than pretty faces that perfectly fit. We don't paint white picket fences in clean neighborhoods where everybody is good, never mentioned on the news. No, we draw wrinkles. And we paint cockeyed, black eyes, blind eyes, busted lips, broken hips, broken homes and broken women used to abusive relationships. More than spades, pluck, and gin rummy, free food and rules to obey, we sculpt crack pipes and pipe dreams. Born, still birthed, broken out of broken glass that cuts deep. As we cry ourselves to sleep, in the morning we use the tears to paint so clear the memories of our babies' faces. We use old blood for the color red, to acknowledge the blood we bled, and for some, the blood we shed. See, we write poems with the pain of our ink pen when we begin to listen to the prisoner within. See, prisoners like me, we don't hide behind the bars, we confront the scars, and meditate on the marks we cry in the broad daylight that we may laugh in the dark. We realize that on a canvas we look like scribbly scrabbly mess, like words misspelled, grammatically incorrect, as our sins are exposed on a blank page, or on a stage, unafraid, unashamed, to be found human.
Our presentation today would not be complete if we didn't share a bit about the history of women in prison. Folks often have stereotyped prisoners as men. However, there is a fast-growing population of women in prison, and that's what we're looking at today, International Women's Day being celebrated on cable.
According to A History and Current Reality, Women and Imprisonment in the U.S. by Nancy Kershaw, the proportion of women in prison has always differed from that of men. Women have traditionally been sent to prison for different reasons, and once in prison, they endure different conditions of incarceration. Women's crimes have often had a sexual definition and been rooted in the patriarchal double standard. Furthermore, the nature of women's imprisonment reflects the position of women in society. Historically, the social stigma and conditions of incarceration have served as a warning to women to stay within the proper female sphere. As we examine women of all nationalities and classes, we realize that this warning is not equally issued. Therefore, historically identifying the race of females in prison in the North and South and pre- and post-Civil War data in the U.S., white supremacy of that era alters the way that gender and race had obvious impact. We note that in the Middle Ages, reports reveal differential treatment of men and women. For instance, a woman might plead her belly, and a pregnant woman could be allowed leniency. During the same era, women were burned at the stake for adultery or murdering a spouse, while men would often not be punished for the same crimes. Prison systems arose with industrialization. For centuries prior to that time, unwanted daughters and wives who had not committed a crime were forced into convents, nunneries, and monasteries, along with political prisoners, illegitimate daughters, physically deformed, and mentally defective folks. In the 1960s, those accused of witchcraft were often executed. Kershaw tells us that the primary determinant of who was designated as being a witch was gender. In fact, men who confessed were likely to be scoffed at as liars. Particularly at risk for witchcraft convictions were women over 40, and women alone and not attached to men as mothers, sisters, or wives. Few women were imprisoned at the beginning of the 19th century in the U.S., and were housed in separate quarters of men's prisons. Like the men, conditions were filthy, overcrowded, and harsh treatment was common. In 1838, in the New York City jail, known as the Tombs, 70 women were crowded into 42 one-person cells. In the 1920s, at Auburn Penitentiary in New York, there were no separate cells for more than 25 women serving sentences up to 14 years. They were lodged in a one-room attic, and the windows were sealed to prevent communication with men. Reports of sexual abuse were frequent. It was known that the Indiana State Prison actually ran a prostitution service for male guards, using female prisoners. Women had less access to the physician and chaplain and did not go to workshops, mess halls, or the exercise yard as the men did. Food and needlework were brought to their quarters, where they remained for the full term of their sentence.
If you just tuned in, KABU is bringing you a special for International Women's Day being presented by Brenda Escobar and Ruth Kovach. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy it.
Rates spiraled in both the North and South after the Civil War, and the Jim Crow laws made newly freed blacks vulnerable to incarceration for the most minor crimes. Stealing a couple chickens brought 3 to 10 years in North Carolina. This meant that by mid-century, there were enough female prisoners to necessitate the trend to provide separate female quarters. In 1869, Sarah Smith and Rhoda Coffin, two Indiana Quakers, led a campaign to end the sexual abuse of women in prison, and in 1874, the first women's prison was built. By 1940, 23 states had separate women's prisons. Women in custodial prisons were frequently convicted of felony charges against property and petty theft. However, data from Auburn, New York on homicide statistics between 1909 and 1933 reveal that, according to Kershaw, women's violent crimes were mostly victims of murder by women who had abused or endangered them. Of 149 victims, two-thirds were male, 29% were husbands, 2% were lovers, and the rest were listed as man or boy. A similar distribution exists today. Another form of violent crime was the imprisonment of women performing illegal abortions. The condition of women's prisons is traditionally deplorable. They're usually placed in the oldest part of a prison structure and were usually in the direct charge of male guards. Women were treated and disciplined the same as the men. Early in the 20th century, various currents of social concern created a new reform effort that had begun between 1840 and 1950. In the reformatories, there was more humane treatment than at the women's penitentiaries. This did eliminate much male abuse and the fear of attack. Children of prisoners up to 2 years old could stay in many institutions. Some of the reformatories were staffed and administered by women. Women are an extremely small proportion of the overall U.S. prison population, only approximately 5%. At the end of 1988, there were just 32,691 women in state and federal prisons. But the number is rapidly rising, after having remained more or less constant for the previous 50 years. We're seeing drug felony charges and misdemeanors for substance abuse. We might ask why the rates are rising more quickly for women. Possibly the deteriorating economic conditions are now pushing women to the brink faster than men. As the primary caretakers of children, women seem to be driven by poverty to commit more crimes of survival. Also, changes in sentencing laws are primarily referred to as the dominant factor of the rising imprisonment rates for women. As we examine the profile of women in prison, we see single mothers of young children with few marketable job skills and high school dropouts who live below the poverty level. Many left home after experiencing sexual and physical abuse. 90% have a drug or alcohol-related history. Race is certainly a factor. 50% of the female prisoners are people of color. Even though only 11% of the total population of this country are Black, 9% are Latino, and 3% Native American. 80% of women entering state prisons are mothers who endure the intense pain of forced separation from their dear children. As the sole caretakers and primary source of financial and emotional support, the loss of contact and care is extremely traumatic for many. Statistics show that their children are twice as likely to end up in foster care than the children of male prisoners who are able to leave the care of their children to wives, mothers, or lovers. This separation and the feeling of guilt and anxiety about their children's welfare is truly the greatest punishment of their incarceration.
Thanks, Brenda. There's much more to be said if we had time to give a complete history of women in prison, but the pattern is there. Usually women were not only treated as harshly as men, but they were frequently exploited sexually. Their special needs as women, such as privacy, feminine hygiene items, and the trauma of separation from their children, were ignored. Their convictions for violent crimes disregarded the element of self-defense after periods of abuse. Their convictions related to drugs were often a result of more serious offenses by partners who plea bargained by pointing the finger at the woman they had used as mules, drug companions, and lovers. If we recognize the need to work for prison reform for men, we must also acknowledge that even more efforts must be focused on women's prisons.
I am an inmate. I am human. By Tamika Lachette Summers. I am human. I am an inmate, the result of a mistake, but I am human first. This is not my fate. The effects make me shake, but it could always be worse. I am real, just like you. Even though I wear blue, I have eyes, I can see. My soul cries and my spirit is free. I am just as human as you are. It might be a stretch of your imagination, but can you try to reach that far? I bleed like every human does, and sometimes I cry, just because. Some days I have are good, and some days are bad. Some days I wish I could have a better life than what I had. I am an inmate, but I am human like you. I am now property of the state, but was once free like you. I am not an animal in the zoo. I am human just like you. When I'm scared, I long to be held, and in so many ways, I am frail. Man has sentenced me to shame and put me in this hell and branded with this name you think you know so well. But do you really know me? I've been conveniently moved from society, forced into this virtual reality. But until I die, I will always be a human like you, part of humanity.
Brenda, that poem really gives us a feeling of how some of these women who are incarcerated feel. Did you enjoy reading that?
Yes, I did. You can definitely, just by reading it, you kind of go through the emotions that they're going through as they're writing this.
That's right, and that's what we're trying to do here today. But you know, there are other women who are an important part of the Women in Prison program we want to bring to you folks today. And those are the ones who are working on reentry programs. So let's hear from a few women who are doing this very important work. Clarina Boston from Better People. Tell us, what is Better People about?
As I indicated, Better People is a program that works with people who have legal histories. And we offer four components of service. I should start out by talking about what the requirements are. If someone is interested, you need to be at least 18 years old, a minimum of 30 days clean and sober. You will be required to attend twice a week cognitive behavioral therapy classes. That's a mouthful. I'll talk about that in a second. And be responsible for a one-time non-refundable enrollment fee. One of the things that Chip was interested in is helping people change the way they think. And so clients are required to attend cognitive behavioral therapy classes.
How much is that enrollment fee?
It's the one-time non-refundable enrollment fee of $35.
Okay.
Our four services are including cognitive behavioral therapy, just as I indicated, getting you to change the way you think in order to change your behavior. We also put together a 16-hour job readiness class, which is a little different than most job readiness programs. It's from the point of view of someone with a legal history. The way our clients go about looking for employment is totally different than someone who would not have that in their background. We also assist our clients in gaining permanent employment. We work with employers who pay at least $9 an hour with health benefits. And then once our clients are employed, we continue to work with them to help them remain employed long term. So that's kind of a quick overview of what we do and kind of how we do it. So we are very pleased to be there. You know, there are people out there, more and more, unfortunately, who make poor decisions. But when they're looking for an opportunity to make change, when they're looking for a second chance to prove that they have changed, sometimes they're frustrated and they don't know where to go. So we're very pleased that we're there on the corner of MLK and Skidmore to be able to provide services to clients in Multnomah County, Washington County, Clackamas County, and even across the river in Clark County. These people make their ways to our door, and we're very pleased to be there to provide services to them.
Solera McFarlane, who now mentors folks after they've been released with Bridges to Change, visited Prison Pipeline and told us about how important it is to have mentors and counselors that have experience with crime and incarceration and release. We're going to hear from her for a few minutes.
First of all, what is House Bill 2442? House Bill 2442 was passed by the legislative session and became an act of law on January 1st of 2010. This bill prohibits those with a criminal history from working in any residential facility that receives government funding. So this includes residential care for elders, hospice, mental health facilities, and drug and alcohol treatment centers. It's a lifetime ban. There's no case-to-case appeal process. Now, because there's many counselors that work in alcohol and drug treatment centers that have criminal histories, there's been an uproar from the recovery community against this bill.
Well, actually, if a person wants to counsel or be a mentor to someone who has an addiction problem and they have never been addicted, they're really just doing the best they can. But the ones who have been there, done that, they know how it feels. They understand how you get addicted. They understand how very, very terrible you can feel and how much you may want to change. They recognize that some folks don't give a darn if they change or not because they kind of like it yet and so on. So this law that says if you've ever been incarcerated, you can't help people who were incarcerated is about as dumb as it can get, isn't it?
I agree. And I don't think it stops there. I don't think it just stops with drug and alcohol treatment. I believe that other than my experience as a criminal and my experience as a drug addict, I have so much more to offer. I'm compassionate. I'm kind. I'm a good listener. I'm understanding. And I'm passionate about what I do. Now, those are things that identify me, who I am. And I really don't feel that people should be identified the rest of their life by a crime they committed years ago.
And according to this bill, 2442, you would not be allowed to be a counsel in this area. Is that right?
That's correct, at least in inpatient treatment centers, which is where I really want to work.
Mm-hmm. So what have you done about this? How do you go about it?
Oh, Ruth, I've been very active on advocating for an amendment to this bill. I've spent countless hours emailing, calling representatives, senators, the governor, pretty much anyone I could find that was willing to listen to me. And we had a tiny triumph, which is that Representative Tina Kotek emailed me back last week with a PDF file assuring me that in the 2011 legislative session, this bill would be amended for alcohol and drug treatment centers. This is a great victory for the recovery community.
Well, how amended will it get? Will everyone be eligible, or will they soften it, or will they make certain requirements? She didn't give you those details, or what?
Well, you know, everyone in the recovery community is very excited because it's no longer going to apply to inpatient drug and alcohol treatment centers. But I do believe this is still a devastating loss for the mental health and elder care community. Just as there are hundreds, if not thousands, of dedicated workers in the alcohol and drug field with criminal histories, there are that many in the mental health and elder care field as well.
Jamaica Amani Nelson served time in prison and now helps those who are being released with their reentry challenges. Tell me a little bit more about Purdy Home.
A little bit more about the Purdy Home is that I've been that woman being released in the middle of the night numerous amounts of times.
What do you mean, the middle of the night?
Under what's called a 1201 release, and they were under the...
A 1201 release?
Midnight, without a meal ticket or a bus ticket, and it was under the pretense that they were overcrowded.
But at 1201, which day were you released? The day that it was when it was 11 o'clock or the day that it is at 1201?
1 minute after midnight.
And why would they do that?
They claim it's overcrowding, but I've seen beds empty. However, I understand the bureaucracy around that. I understand that when you're released out into the middle of the night with an addiction, a substance abuse problem, into downtown Dope Haven, Portland, Oregon, without a meal ticket or a bus ticket, what do you do? Where do you go? But back to what you know.
Find a fix. Find it now.
And find a crime to commit to get another fixed and find yourself back in a jail cell, doing it all over again. It's called a vicious cycle of addiction and insanity.
So you think the people who perpetrate these 1201 releases are in that group that wants to keep the prisons full?
I think it wants to. It's about job security, if I could speak candidly.
Another thing I think that you're not mentioning, but I've always been aware of, is when they release you at 1201, the state pays a certain amount to the prison for their budget for each day that the number of prisoners that are there. So if you're there until midnight, they got paid for that day, and if they wait until 1 minute after midnight, they get paid for the next day too. So they got an extra day's pay for having. Is that true? That's the way the system works. Just keep them 5 more minutes and we get another day's allotment because they count on that day.
Yeah, I get that.
You get that?
I get that.
And how easy is it to find someone who's going to come meet you at 1201 or to find a bus or to find a way home to find a room?
It's next to impossible.
In fact, to even find a hamburger.
It's next to impossible.
And especially, we're not talking about prisons
that are in the middle of downtown Portland, you know, where the prison is in Salem. It's really still in Salem, but it's a long walk to the nearest restaurant or the nearest, you know. It's not a nice place to be at 1201.
Salem, I don't believe you to release people in the middle of the night. They're typically released in the morning. We're talking about the ladies and the gentlemen on a county level, Multnomah County Detention Center. And sometimes they are truly overcrowded. I get that. But my point being is, how conducive is it to ever release anyone during hours when no community resources are available? It's next to inhumane.
That's right. So what do you think about the support that you've had from family and friends?
You know, fortunately, I've been one to have had a phenomenal amount of support from family, from friends, from organizations, from the reentry programs, and it's been a good run for me. But I'm not saying it's been easy, because it hasn't been. I had to keep my nose to the grindstone. I have to stay focused. I know that I'm one bad decision away from Burnside. I'm one bad decision away from that county jail. I'm one bad decision away from death. And one thing about me, if I make one wrong move, I get to lose everything. I lose the family, the husband, the job, the kids, the car, everything. I lose it all. It's a domino effect. And the price tag attached to the old friends and the old associations and the old habits is far too high to pay. And I get that today.
Imagine How It Feels by Tamika Lachette Summers, currently in Lowell Correctional Institution in Ocala, Florida. Imagine how it feels to be in a place you don't belong, to be surrounded by unfamiliarity, and every move you make is wrong. Imagine how it feels to always be on someone else's time, to be caged in like an animal in the midst of your prime. Imagine how it feels to have to always pretend or repeat the same day over and over again. Imagine how it feels to wear the same clothes every single day, or not have a place to run to so you can get away. Imagine how it feels to go to bed heartbroken every night, or to wake up in the mornings and never see sunlight. Can you imagine how it feels not to breathe fresh air, or to just exist with no one to care? Imagine how it feels never fitting in, always compromising your values and falling into sin. Imagine how it feels to wish for death, to spend day and night contemplating how to take your last breath. Imagine how it feels to feel alone and strange, knowing that any second now, things could up and change. Now imagine having a nightmare, only this is for real. You still couldn't even begin to imagine how it feels.
If you just tuned in, KABU is bringing you a special for International Women's Day being presented by Brenda Escobar and Ruth Kovach. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy it. Reports of women being held in prisons for political actions in South Africa, Israel, Egypt, Iran, Northern Ireland, Burma, El Salvador, and more also include a number of executions for those prisoners. These reports often do not provide names and usually are denied by the current political powers. However, countless reliable reporters and folks who have been released or managed to escape confirm that indeed the confinement, torture, and execution of women all over the world who have bravely taken a stand for their viewpoint are in grave danger. High security units in the U.S., called HSUs, are believed to now hold more than 150 women charged with anti-imperialistic actions. Also, fingers are pointed at women incarcerated and some who have been executed that are convicted for crimes that they were framed for, but the true reason for their arrest was their anti-government actions.
Cases of prisoners taking a leadership role in prisoner organizing and resistance become political prisoners as their sentence is extended and time in solitary confinement is very common. Just to name a few that we know about, we pause to remember these cases.
Assata Shakur, a Black Panther member and revolutionary writer, raised in New York, convicted in 1973, but escaped and now lives in Cuba in political asylum and continues to speak out.
Linda Evans, an American actress born in Connecticut, spent 16 years in federal prison, convicted of being an anti-imperialism activist. She was eventually released.
Susan Rosenberg, a longtime anti-imperialist activist who participated in four bombings on U.S. and military installations. There were no injuries, only property damage, but Rosenberg is serving a life sentence.
Norma Jean Croy, a Native American, now serving a life sentence for first-degree murder after an encounter that ended in the death of a police officer who was shot by someone else.
Ramona Africa, convicted with nine others after an encounter with the Philadelphia police who illegally bombed the homes of folks from MOVE. Dead were six adults and five children from MOVE, and 60 homes were burned to the ground. One policeman was shot, and although the court could not identify who shot the police officer, nine MOVE members served 29 years or more.
Lynn Stewart, convicted in 2005 on charges of conspiracy. She was convicted of helping pass messages from her client, an Egyptian cleric, to his followers. Also, she was convicted of perjury at her trial. Although her supporters still appeal and point to her innocence, Stewart, now age 71, was recently resentenced on remand to 10 more years in prison. There are so many more. Each is a story that has been explored by journalists, but basically, the facts are not accurately or completely presented to the public. Why did the press and internet give attention to O.J. Simpson or Michael Jackson? Certainly newsworthy events, but months of headline stories and every possible related story. However, they bury the stories of political convictions and sentencing. This is just more evidence that certain political powers do not want us to hear the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I apologize for not giving this subject more time, but so much of the research I was able to do was inconsistent and unreliable. However, the pattern is there, and I urge those who want to know more to contact organizations such as Women Against Imperialism, Out of Control, or Interfaith Prisoners of Conscience Project. Thank you.
"20 Years Through My Eyes" by Rhonda Solomon Wheeler, number 763-1017, Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville, Oregon. "The man in the black robe who sat before me said, 'Lock her up and throw away the key.' The first year was hardest with its bullies and thugs. The second and fifth was when they lost me with drugs. My sixth and seventh went by pretty fast. I was seeing a light letting go of the past. I see a lot of years, 8, 9, and 10, the end of a decade with another yet to begin. I've seen families form where once were none, battles among enemies with no prizes won. In the visiting room where moms and children play, the sound of their cries leaving when mommy has to stay. By the 15th year, I'd seen more than my share, more tears and heartache than a human should have to bear. Women crying, having to face a death, women kicking heroin in the faces of meth, women losing their sanity, being locked in a cell, some losing their lives, some with stories to tell. 20 years later, I'm tired and old, with years of learning and stories to be told. 20 years later, my, how time flies. Let me tell you what I've seen in 20 years through my eyes."
Another important group of folks who help our prisoners are the volunteers that visit the prisons. There's quite a few. In fact, there are 2,000 volunteers in the state of Oregon that visit prisons, and 47% of them are women. We have a few comments from Terry and Gretchen and Sandy, just a few of the many women that visit prisons in order to encourage our prisoners and help give them directions for their reentry program.
My name's Terry Stein, and I'm got started volunteering when an acquaintance of mine received a long prison sentence. And previously, I hadn't been interested in the prison system. I thought I kind of knew how it operated, but I found out differently. And I couldn't really do anything much to help my friend except stay in touch with him. So I got involved with Oregon Cure, which is an advocacy organization. And I was been involved with them for a little over 10 years now, I think. And through that, I became aware of an organization called Seventh Step. And I have volunteered with them, and I'm currently the acting president of the outside board. Seventh Step is an organization of incarcerated citizens. It's at Oregon State Penitentiary. And the purpose of Seventh Step is for men to recognize their errors and learn about themselves and how to live a more productive and pro-social life when they get out. I feel it's important for me and people like myself to be involved in promoting that. And so we go in once a month, meet with the incarcerated citizens and with the men, and just kind of hear from them. They hear from us. We help them find and contact speakers to come into their meetings and talk about different topics. And we are, as an organization, on the outside, wanting to start doing some more services. We want to start a Codependence Anonymous group, and quite a few of the men are interested in taking part in that once it gets going. And we want to eventually be able to start a mentoring program for men when they get out, and also somewhere down the line, maybe even transitional housing. And I think the more that we can do to help men and women who've been incarcerated be able to get on the right track and stay on the right track after they're released, the more safe and the more positive, I guess, our communities are going to be for all of us. And that's why I believe it's important.
Hi, my name is Gretchen, and I volunteer at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. This is the women's prison in Wilsonville. I go in once a quarter, and I am able to visit with women who are in the Red Hat Behind Bars Club. I also go into Columbia River Correctional Facility. I go in once or twice a year, and I volunteer for the children's events. And these would be situations where men who have passed the parenting program are able to have a meal and spend some time with their families. I am the mother of a young man who is in prison currently. He's at the Snake River Correctional Facility in Ontario, Oregon.
Hi, I'm Sandy. I visit at, I visit the Oregon State Penitentiary, but I am a volunteer there. Actually, I don't have a volunteer card because I used to be married to a Folsom Prison inmate who got transferred up here. And after my husband got out and, immediately succumbed to a lot of the problems of transition, we broke up, and then someone named Harvey that was very active in Seven Steps said, why don't you come down and help us, because he knew that I was so dedicated to finding out the reasons people are in prison and trying to help stem the tide of people going to prison. So I did that, and I was vice chair of CURE for a number of years. That's Citizens United for Rehabilitation of Errants. And with Seventh Step, which is a group of offenders and former offenders and other volunteers who work on activities that will keep them out once they get out. So they might be in or they might be out, but they're working on, changing whatever they believe, were some of the problems that had them end up in prison. Oh, excuse me. The one thing I want to say is how much the prisoners appreciate any contact with the outside. And the other thing I want to say is the prisoners are us. When I worked at Folsom Prison, that is when I realized it. When I had to tour the prison and I saw hundreds of people, they were people. And I don't know what I was thinking beforehand, but I have seen this phenomenon for 20 years as a volunteer, that people come into the prison and they're nervous and they go, oh, I've never been in a prison before. And they visit with our group, the seven-step group, and when they leave, invariably they say, well, those guys are so nice, and they're just like regular people. So I think that that is the thing that I would wish that people would remember, because they are regular people, and many of them don't belong there because they didn't do the crime, and many of them do belong there because they did the crime, but they need help. And then still others are going to go either way, depending on who's going to intervene, you know, who's going to help, because a lot of them didn't get there because they were model citizens. They've been, disadvantaged their entire lives. So with my ex-husband, it was one thing after another that seemed strange to me. Like, you know, he said he had never known anyone who was a citizen, a real citizen. And so by watching me, I was his first role model of what a law-abiding, responsible citizen would do. Anyway, there, I just have to say that after volunteering at several prisons and with youth and studying parenting and teaching parenting, I know that we are doing very little of what really works. In Oregon, we are very lucky to have volunteers, because when I was in California, no one would allow people to come in. And that's one of the most fundamental things about this system. It's not working, and people are paying so much because they don't know what's going on there. So in California, it's very corrupt. In Oregon, it isn't. In Oregon, you know, they allow outsiders to come in and try to help, keep people in touch with the community. And anyway, I think I'm rambling a bit. So the thing that I would like to leave you with is just that, there but for fortune go you and I. And if you don't believe me, then you just wait. And someday you'll be very surprised to learn that someone you know has been in prison, or you'll be surprised that your son or your husband or somebody is either unjustly arrested, or you'll have some contact with the prison system, because we have way, way too many people in there. And, it's not effective. So anyway, I get a lot out of going in there, because the inmates are so thankful and they really listen. And, you got a captive audience. What can I say? All right, thanks. I'm going to say goodbye now. Bye.
Well, we saved the volunteers till the last, because I'm hoping that those of you who are listening that would be able to volunteer would consider doing that. Actually, the folks that go to the prison always come away saying, I got more out of it than the prisoners did. Because as you interact one-on-one with prisoners, you hear their stories, you start to understand how they feel, you start to hear stories about how they wound up in a life of crime and then being arrested and then being convicted and then serving time. You start to understand, as you speak to the loved ones of these folks, that the sisters and the mothers and the brothers and the family is all doing their time with them. And we know that the community of prisoners and their families is a very large one. There are 2.7 million folks incarcerated in the United States, and it would be easy to guess that at least 3 to 5 people are very, very much affected by their incarceration, their children, their parents, their friends, their neighbor. In fact, 3 is just a conservative guess. And so the community of folks that we hope to reach with Prison Pipeline and with this program and with the outreach programs that are done by all the organizations who are working on reentry programs, educational programs, recreational programs, faith-based programs, we all have the same goal, and that is to provide programs that will make a transition of someone who was incarcerated from a life of crime, spent their time, did their studying, did their self-evaluation, and finally are released into our society as even more productive and better citizens than they were before they even thought of a crime. Brenda, do you think we're accomplishing that with some of the programs that we provide?
I'd like to think that we are.
And that's why we've selected the ones that we've done. And Brenda has been a help to me on presenting not just this program, but Prison Pipeline, because she seems to have a sense of knowing what is the mission of this program. And I hope that we have accomplished our mission today, that all of you who are listening are enjoying what you hear, but learning from it, because this is an attempt to educate you, not to entertain you. And so thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate your support of KBOO, who tries to give you the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and particularly of Prison Pipeline, that tries to work with the community that is out there all over the nation. And Brenda, would you tell some of the folks, if they go to our website, how people in other states could be listening to Prison Pipeline?
Yes, you can go to www.kboo.fm/prisonpipeline, and there we have shows, past shows, so you can listen to those anytime. And also, for those of you that want to listen that are out of state and would like to listen live, every Monday, 6:30 p.m. Pacific time, you can go to the same website. You can go to www.kboo.fm, and then there's like a little button or like an icon in the top right-hand corner of the website, and it says Listen Live or Listen Now, something like that. And you just click it, and you can listen to us live. And you can always email us at prisonpipeline@gmail.com with any questions or comments about any shows. And we would really appreciate that. We'd like to hear your feedback.
Thank you, Brenda. And I hope some of you take advantage of that very simple procedure to listen to more programs. Be sure to let us know if there are things that you want to hear about prisons, because we want to educate you, help you, and make you feel really comfortable about the time that your loved one is serving. And as we close our International Women's Special, I want to be sure to thank a few folks.
Thanks to Prisons Foundation in Washington, D.C. for the Women in Prison on Death Row play.
And to Sarika Mehta and Brenda Escobar for reading poems from Cell Block Poetry.
And to Ruth Kovacs for the piano music we heard under the poems.
And here's a shout out and thanks for listening to all the folks in lockdown that were with us today.
And of course, thanks to the friends, families, and loved ones that are our faithful listeners.
We appreciate being part of the KBOO family that makes programs like this possible.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you, Brenda.